Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of The Publisher Lab. My name is Terrence Timmons, and I'm here today joined with Zach Ashman. Thanks for having you on the show. And of course, we have our beloved Manny helping us with everything podcast related. How is everyone doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Manny?
I'm doing good. From the great beyond.
Awesome. Well, since everyone's having a great day, here in San Diego, it's been a little weird. We got floods. It's kind of out of the blue. But San Diego will survive, you know. We're paddleboarding on freeways. So we want to get into the show. We have a couple awesome stories to go over. First, we want to talk a little bit about Google News.
So we got this story coming out of SEORoundtable.com. Google responds to the claims of Google News boosting garbage AI content. Now, Danny Sullivan, the Google search liaison, has responded to these allegations made by 404 Media in their article titled Google News is boosting garbage AI-generated articles. And Sullivan clarified that Google News does not boost AI-generated content in their search results. He explained that the instances cited by the article were due to specific filters and searches, not the default settings of Google News, emphasizing Google's commitment to quality content. Sullivan stated that low-quality articles, regardless of how they are produced, are contrary to Google's policies. He acknowledged the ongoing efforts to refine Google's ranking system to better support quality journalism. Sullivan also addressed the challenges new publishers like 404 Media face in gaining recognition on Google News. Noting that it takes time for their content to be surfaced, he advised publications with paywalls or gated content to grant access to Google's crawler for improved understanding of their work, while still upholding their registration requirements. So what's your take on all of this, you guys? Do you guys think that Google is just boosting AI-generated content?
Yeah, I think, Terrence, I think you actually had a really good point about, before we were talking about this, like the nature of the article. Can you kind of expand first on that before we jump into the meat of that?
Yeah. So if I understand this article correctly, how I see it is there is a media company, 404 Media, is complaining to Google saying, hey, our Google search is showing a ton of low-quality AI-generated content. And why aren't we ranking? Because we're putting in all of this work. Our content's of high quality. Why aren't we ranking? And then Google comes back and says, hey, look, first of all, the data you shared with us, the screenshots, shows you're using, you know, Google search in not a normal way for users. So instead of sorting by relevancy in their Google search, in the Google News, they sorted by most recent, right? So that will bring up any news content that fits the requirements, not content that is high quality or relevant to users. So that's number one. And then number two, Google says, hey, we acknowledge that we could be a little bit better at promoting other news articles faster. So if you're a new news site, we could do a better job at that. So with those two points, how I see this is someone kind of saw an issue, i.e. their site not ranking, try to find a reason for it, and then try to complain to it, and then they just throw it on this AI monster saying, hey, AI is the reason we're not ranking, when in reality, it's a little bit more nuanced, right? They said, hey, look, AI content might be in the searches. It's probably not. All we care about is if it's high quality or not. So if your content is really good and it answers users' questions well and it's helpful to the user and relevant to whatever they're searching for, it will rank. It could be AI-assisted or not. That doesn't matter as long as it meets those four criteria I just mentioned. So this, to me, looks like 404 Media was kind of complaining a little bit and trying to get an answer and trying to find an answer that wasn't really there.
Yeah. Yeah, and so along with that explanation of the article and on top of the extreme difficulties with Google News, this article makes a lot of sense, and I think Sullivan's response was good and needed. Because the way I think about Google News is, have you ever seen those guys on the street where They're like got like a band. They're like a one man band. You know, they've got a harmonica, yeah. a drum kit, a guitar, everything like that. That's how I think of Google News sites. They have to be doing all of those things all at the same time really, really well. And so you could think about the drums as having really popular technical and mm-hmm. back-end things implemented, the harmonicas, all the great content that you're putting out, and you fill in the blanks for everything else. It is extremely difficult to consistently appear in Google News because there is Google has to answer the question of journalistic integrity yeah. every time that they put up a story in someone's top 10.
So they need to trust you.
They have to trust you more than they trust a lot of people, because if Google and so it explains why this is a difficult thing to get right.
Yeah.
It's not always going to be perfect. It's not always going to be fine-tuned, because they have to consider a public opinion. And if they promote a news story that's false, or if they promote a news story that is irrelevant, is
misinformation.
Misinformation and inciting things that aren't true. Like all of it kind of goes back. There's a lot that goes into it. So, every media company, more power to you, honestly, to get ranked up in there.
So I have a question for you, Zach, since you are an SEO expert, and if you saw 404 Media kind of complaining about this, what would be your advice to maybe, you know, young startups that are trying to get, you know, ranked into Google News, considering it's a very high bar of entry? But of course, you know, you still want to facilitate an environment where startups can come in and make a business for themselves. What would be your general recommendations? Is it just take it slow, making sure you build up authority and trust first? How would you sort of advise that?
Yeah, great question. As a disclaimer,
of course.
Like the one band band, yeah. I may be, I'd have to have a couple pages of documents in front of me to explain how to play every instrument. So I'm only going to touch on maybe a few of them. It's not a comprehensive list, but the first thing that comes to mind is probably just two things to focus on. The first one is basic. Honestly, I feel like everyone at this point hates me for bringing this up. It's EAT. I love EAT.
Yeah.
I love bringing it up. So you got to have some great transparency. You're really demonstrating, hey, this is why you should trust me. That's essentially what EAT is looking for. Making sure that's really apparent is always a great thing to have on your site. So make sure that that's great. There's so many great articles out there on how to do that well.
So first thing is transparency, and then your second one is going to be?
Is making sure that you focus on specific topics a lot. Something that I see a lot of publishers do, is that they focus on so many different topics and they're just trying to go to the different hot topics at that moment in time, which is great. However, something that I would encourage people to consider is if you're a giant tech news site,
mm-hmm.
tech involves anything from AI to Radio Shack that doesn't exist anymore. So there's so much that you could talk about. I'd pick maybe two or three topics that you know really well that you can write about almost every day and just keep writing about those couple topics. Make some great category pages around those. And over time, those three topics, you're going to become a trustworthy, wonderful person that Google News knows, Google Discover knows, and they're going to keep continuously recognizing you in that by putting you higher and higher in the search results because they know that you write about those three things all the time.
So keep it specific. So if you're in, let's say, tech news, let's say I'm only going to focus on Apple products and then maybe Android and one other thing, and then only that.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, I mean, of course, like, this is when it gets to being, you know, you need, obviously the best would be a media company where you have multiple writers that can write about these different topics and you can, you know, kind of conquer all lands. However, Apple, Android, those are all good things, but even think more specifically, because if you can think of something within Apple, like iPhone, or if you can think of Mac, getting into these specific things where you are the guaranteed trusted person in this, That is a really good kind of mindset to have. So the so of course, keep it, you know, you can keep it broad, but the more that you write about things specifically, I've seen success in people ranking higher in these different platforms of Discover and News with these different types of strategies. But again, put out the disclaimer, I am teaching the drums right now. 100%. I am not teaching them harmonica or anything else. There's a lot more that goes into it, but those are two of the things that I would say most people could do easily.
Yeah. And then I imagine once you've gotten those 2 points down, then it's easier for you to expand into those other instruments, right? You got the drums down. All right, now we can add on the harmonica.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe then that means expanding to other topics, you know, or branching out a little bit. But you first need to have those two down.
I think those two are really good starting points. And I think if they can do that and write consistently every day, I think they're at a really good spot to start.
Awesome. Well, that was a very insightful answer. I learned a little bit too, but it does go to show how much actually goes into Google News. So I guess that kind of gives us a segue into our next story, which is there was a new study done on Google search, whether it is getting worse or not. Do you want to lead us away on that, Manny?
Yeah, so we got a team from Leipzig University, Bauhaus Universität Weimar, and SCADS.AI in Germany conducted a comprehensive study to evaluate the search quality of major search engines like Google Search, Bing, and DuckDuckGo. Focusing on product review searches, the study analyzed 7,392 unique queries from October 2022 to September 2023. It revealed a notable issue with dynamic adversarial spam, where low-quality commercial content floods search results. Google's efforts to downrank certain affiliate pages were observed towards the end of August 2023, hinting at a possible trend shift. However, the study highlighted the higher-ranking pages often showed signs of being heavily optimized for monetization, with a decrease in text quality. Despite Google's algorithmic updates targeting SEO and affiliate spam, the effects were mostly temporary. The study did not cover the latest reviews updates in November 2023, and future analysis could be challenging without Google's confirmation of updates. And before, when we were discussing this, Zach, you had mentioned that there were how many Google updates in the last year?
I believe since the end of 2021, there's been 8 specific updates targeted specifically to product review content. So really 2022, 2023, there's about 8, which spam content got, like, there are specific also spam updates that Google will do. Spam updates got a little bit more than 8. I think there was somewhere maybe around a dozen. It's not like they're spending so much time on it. There's plenty of other things that they make updates about. This study is really interesting because the study examined search results from October 26, 2022 to September 19th, 2023. So plenty of updates for product reviews happened in that time. So it'd be really interesting to kind of really talk to maybe some of these people that were in the study and see, like, you know, from this update to this update, did you notice any notable changes within the rankings for XYZ keywords? And kind of be more specific with it. As you had said, like, there's an issue with dynamic adversarial spam where low quality commercial content flood search results. That happens with almost every search. Google has an insurmountable task ahead of them always, of making sure that their algorithmic updates are promoting the best possible people and demoting the most worthy people as well, which is a really hard task, especially when it comes to product content, because product content makes a lot of people a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And if you can, you know, if you can sell, your toaster that you're promoting from Amazon and your affiliate link, you can make a couple $100 on top of what you'd be getting from traffic. Mm-hmm. So it's a big thing, which is why they spend so much time on it.
Yep.
And they're making sure that it's done well, because when I go to look up different parts or different items and stuff like that, especially when it comes to review, Google more recently from the helpful content update has honestly just kind of scratched that idea of a lot of these product and affiliate links and just started promoting just the brands themselves. So for example, if I were to look up, let's just say, I guess a lawnmower, that's the first thing that comes to mind. If I look up a lawnmower, you
see John Deere, or
you will see John Deere, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ace Hardware. Why? Because, well, for one, Home Depot specifically, whoever they hired to do their content and SEO, kudos to them, because they started writing a lot of content about these specific keywords because they knew that they could get a lot more people to come in their doors if they could write some good content and rank high. And Home Depot obviously has a fantastic amount of authority here in the States. So it's a perfect scheme for them. And Google's jumped on that because they know for a fact, one, they're a company traded on the stock market. One, pretty That's trustworthy. True. Number two, they are in every single state in the U.S. as well. Very well trusted there. And overall, they know that they're consistently providing a good service that more often than not isn't AI and isn't spam. Therefore, they're going to promote them further. So it's a really – so if you are kind of a mom and pop shop website that is trying to just to produce – you know, good content. Hey, I bought these, you know, three toasters and I want to review them with you guys. It's going to be hard to beat out, you know, these bigger companies because honestly, it's just such kind of a big, this is a really harsh word. It's a big cesspool of different people just spamming content, trying to make the quick buck, and they're not actually really 100% abiding by the guidelines where Home Depot can kind of get away with it.
Yeah.
They don't have to own every single product because they sell every single product.
I have a question for you, Zach. Since from what I'm picking up here is you're saying instead of these mom and pop affiliate sites, instead of like Tom being like, this is my favorite lawnmower, instead of that being, you know, the top result coming from like a person buying it, presumably, it's now Lowe's or Home Depot, it's going to be their lawnmower top. So my question is, if you see all these big brands coming to the top, now you mentioned some hints in there, they might be coming to the top regardless of how good their SEO is or quality of content is, then could that imply that maybe some of these brands do have lower quality content, but they just get pushed to the top because of that trustworthy and authority we talked about earlier? Or is it, you know, Google will still individually look at these brands and see, is this content good? And if the answer is yes, it comes to the top. If the answer is no, then they'll bring up someone else that has higher content or better content in that case.
Yeah, great question. What I've seen lately is the first point of what you made. What I've seen lately is that it'll be the bigger brands.
More bigger brands, yeah.
And they may have lower quality content, but because they're the brand and Google for a fact can trust them, they'll rank them higher. However, that's not the case because some of them make sense.
Yeah.
So for example, I was looking at a, Manny, I'm going to send you this picture so that you can put this on the podcast. Essentially I looked at this specific search result for a tech term, a specific software within Azure, the Microsoft security platform. And the first like seven results were either was MicrosoftLearn.com, the community forum and like that forum, or Reddit. I think one tech media company was up there that's been doing it for a really long time. So there is very little room in search results right now for a lot of big keywords for mom and pop shops and mom and pop websites. Because I think Google's in this weird kind of middle ground of, I mentioned this, I believe, the last time I was on the podcast. Google had to ask themselves, how do we consistently provide non-AI, non-spammy content as consistently as possible for every search result? First of all, that's an impossible question to answer, but the way they chose to do it was big brands, old content, or community forums. Those three things are usually, I'd say, within, you know, 90%+ consistently non-AI and not spam.
Yeah.
But of course, that just pushes out publishers so hard. And it's really hard to find keywords and search results that they can consistently rank for when so many of these brands can come in with their current algorithm, or even Reddit can come in and swoop in and take that traffic.
I've seen that firsthand too. I did want to run a little story by you, which was, so I run a website on my own that's about book summaries, all right? And there's a couple keywords where I noticed the author's website will show up in the feature snippet for some keywords, but then other keywords, it doesn't even show up, maybe top 10. And I realized when it comes to like intent of the keyword, so let's say someone types in title, summary, if the intent is just to like get a quick review in or maybe buy it, it's more likely to have the author in there. But if it's more related to, I realize, to high school students and like a cheat sheet and study guide, then it's less likely to put the author book in. So that was just my example. And I'm using the author's website as like the brand in this case, because their name is on the book. Their name is, you know, on their website. They're easily established. You can find them up. So I'm sure Google could figure that out. So I guess my experience was, I do see some cases where you can still find angles where you could get value from a mom and pop shop. But it sounds like most, like a majority of these use cases are being covered by brands. Is that like a correct assessment just from looking at like a simple example like that? I know it's a big question I'm throwing at you, but I would just kind of wanted to open up the conversation about, you know, how would you look at that result and how would you think about that?
Yeah. Like you said, every search result is going to have a unique intent that it's identified from the different people searching it.
Yeah.
Some, if you were to look up probably Rick Riordan, the guy
who literally sounds the book I was referencing.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So if you look up Rick Riordan, and Rick Riordan's, you know, The Lightning Thief summary.
Yep.
You're probably gonna get a Google snippet.
It's his website.
Or his website, yeah.
Or one of those snippets, yeah.
That makes sense. And so some like that one for me, Rick Riordan, you know, Prince The Lightning Thief summary. And if Rick Riordan comes up as number one, all right, it kind of makes sense,
right?
Whereas if you were just to look up Rick Riordan and not do anything else, then it's probably Wikipedia and these different things.
Or it's about the movie or the show instead of the book.
Or the movie or the show. Yeah. So, I mean, I think some of the bigger keywords in there, Google is going to trust the bigger brands and the more broad terms.
So almost long tail keywords is where the opportunity still lies. From a publisher standpoint.
From a publisher standpoint, it's really going to – the reason I'm hesitant and I'm kind of thinking through your question is because each of the niches that publishers engage with are going to be very different how they have an experience like of what you're asking.
So each niche will have its own set of criteria, and then you being the expert in that niche will need to identify that criteria, look at those keywords and see, is long tail available here? And if it is, go for it. But maybe in a different niche, long tail is not available, so you can't really go for it.
Yeah, I encourage publishers to consistently look at their search results for the keywords that they want to rank for and see if it's possible, because it should be pretty identified. It should be, even though, because publishers can come in and say, well, I have better content than these top three people in the search result. That's awesome. But again, that's you just playing the drums. Are you doing everything else?
Yeah.
And if you aren't, and one of those big concepts is authority and trustworthiness. How long have you been around? You have to consistently ask the question, am I the absolute best result for this
keyword? Do I have authority elsewhere outside of search? You know, can people find me elsewhere?
Exactly.
Is my brand recognizable?
Things like that. Yeah. And again, you know, this conversation we're having are just small aspects of a much larger conversation that needs to happen with every publisher and the keywords they want to rank for, because it's different across every single niche. So hard to answer that question fully, but take a look at the big keywords, see who's coming up, and you can get lucky. And okay, great. I know I can go for this. I'm gonna try and create a strategy around it. But of course, tried and true. Yeah, if a keyword only gets, you know, 400 search volume a month or something like that, odds are usually nowadays it's still accessible for anybody, really.
Yeah. Well, I brought up the question because I wanted to almost, you know, to kind of spearhead into the discussion a little bit to try to get value, because I'm sure publishers that listen to this pod run into this dilemma every single day when they look at their results of their site and their keywords are ranking for, and they see maybe, oh, I lost keywords here or gained keywords here. So that's like a question that's probably always in the head for those publishers that are looking at that data. So that's why I wanted to sort of expand this discussion just a little bit, you know, just to sort of give some help in some areas that we can.
Yeah. And my last point on this, and then we'll keep moving on to the next one. some of my biggest encouragements for publishers facing that right now is to set and limit expectations. You can only do so much with what Google's given us. Google's algorithm is operating in this way that we've just discussed right now. In 10 months, that could be completely different, and we'll have to change again. So right now, my best advice to limit kind of the disappointment and frustration is just to limit expectations. You might have noticed a traffic decrease. Well, work with what you have. Look at the keywords that you're doing really well for. See if you can find a pattern. Look in the different search results that you're having a really hard time with. Look at the top three results. What patterns are you finding? Yep. What are the different things that you can identify that you can do to your content to overall make it better? And overall, just continue to make yourself as transparent and as reliable as possible. Continuously ask the question, why does Google trust me? Am I giving them enough reasons to trust me? And overall, why am I the best result? These are big questions, but they have to be answered in the current landscape of search results because it's tough out there. I get it.
Yeah, it is tough. So I guess to boil things down, it's, you know, the current meta has shifted in this sense that now it's talking about transparency, your authority, your brand, and that is super important now, but that meta could shift to something else. So just go down and look at your due diligence, you know, get to work, and then look at your data, and then, you know, kind of just take it day by day.
Yeah. Awesome. Manny, do you want to lead us into the next topic?
Yeah, so we got some social media news that's going to blend in with some publishing news. I wanted to start off by asking you guys, are you guys both avid Facebook users for any reason, personal?
I used to be, but now I just have a Facebook page for some websites I own.
You're not poking anybody on Facebook anymore?
No. Not sending happy birthday on their walls either.
So I guess this would be a terrible time for you to ask you if you can water my plants on Farmville.
Yeah, this would be a terrible time to ask for that.
Well, we have a report here from the searchengineland.com that a study was done by the Consumer Reports, which revealed a surprising revelation about how many companies track an individual Facebook user. On average, each Facebook user has their data shared with approximately 2,200 companies, with some users' information being distributed to as many as 7,000 companies. And this extensive data sharing raises significant concerns about privacy, trust, and compliance with regulations, especially in the European Union. And that kind of ties into the concept of you really see how many people are tracking someone at like an individual time. So whenever you input any information about yourself online, Facebook, social media, we're all just being tracked consistently. And that kind of ties into the new concept, especially with Google Chrome making an update at the beginning of the year, where they're trying to get rid of third-party cookies to really protect this data that we have and everyone's individual privacy. However, article from digiday.com titled "The U.S. Publishers Are Experiencing Testing Fatigue as They Evaluate Alternative IDs to Third-Party Cookies." Now, U.S. publishers, unlike their European counterparts who are rejecting third-party cookie alternatives, are actively testing various universal identifiers to replace these cookies. This initiative, however, is causing significant fatigue due to the complexity and resource-intensive nature of the testing process. Notable publishers like Condé Nast and Hearst are prioritizing first-party data offerings while still exploring these alternatives. The alternative identifiers, while offering advantages like frequency capping, also require publishers to surrender some control, a concern echoed by industry players. For instance, Justin Wool of Salon, TV Tropes, and Snopes has chosen Unified ID2 exclusively, expressing frustration with other alternatives. The major challenge lies in the complexity of proper testing, with Sincera data indicating that few publishers are conducting rigorous single ID tests with significant within segmented traffic cohorts. In fact, anecdotal estimates suggest less than 5% of U.S. publishers have completed adequate testing, and this comprehensive testing involving holdout groups is both complex and time-consuming, leading many publishers to shy away from fully embracing these alternatives. Now, in a separate article from DigiDay as well, they're saying that publishers like Salon, Snopes, and TB Tropes, as previously mentioned, are beginning to see substantial revenue increases from alternative identifiers. Justin Wohl of these companies reported 200% raise in CPMs using Unified ID2 compared to traditional third-party cookie methods. Similarly, Unwind Media noted a 40 to 50% CPM boost with identifiers like RampID and UID 2.0. This transition is part of a broader strategy to adapt to the decline of third-party cookies, with publishers increasingly focused on first-party deterministic IDs and encouraging user self-authentication on their sites. However, the industry is still in a state of flux. While some publishers are actively testing and seeing positive results, others are still exploring and narrowing down their options. Publishers like Future are experimenting with various solutions like LiveRamp's authenticated traffic solutions and Google's publisher-provided signals. Despite these promises and developments, there's still uncertainty about which alternative IDs will ultimately prevail, and some publishers remain cautious. How familiar are you guys with these new IDs, and have you guys seen any revenue uplift, change, any like spikes in information, anything that's really could point publishers in the right direction of what they need to do?
So yeah, this is a lot to go off of, and a kind of a big question. So I want to start things off by just explaining a little bit of what is happening with, you know, people say third-party cookies are going away, privacy concerns, and that whole story we have going on. So first things to start is the public perception is caring more and more about privacy, of their data. So for example, a user would want to know which company is tracking the data and can they do anything about it. So GDPR started this whole thing in Europe, which is basically saying, hey, you need to express what data you have on users. And that's like every website, every app. And the European Union was the first one to do this. Now the United States is lagging, right? So how do cookies play into this privacy thing? So cookies on the web are just a simple tool where you can use it to do functionality in a website, like tracking your user login information, right? Super simple. Or you can use it to remember what items you put in your shopping cart if you're on a shopping site, right? But there's also other uses. And the other uses are it can hold data about you as an individual, right? So if you're using a Chrome browser and there's cookies and you're on a website, it could say, hey, you went to this website, you were on it for this long, you were on this type of device, you were at this time of day, this location, and it can be very extensive on that information. So right now that information is passed in a third-party cookie and that is then sent to advertisers and they can then adjust their advertising bidding behavior based off it. So for example, if I'm a male, 28, live here in San Diego, I have an iPhone 12, give a lot of personal information right now. I may be on, let's say, I'm on Reddit at, let's say, 12 p.m. On average in the middle of the day, right? So then they can take that information and then basically approximate what kind of ads I would like to see, right? Now, if they didn't have the information, then it won't really hit the spot, right? If I'm using SEMrush and I'm on SEMrush's website and get a cookie, then it makes sense for me to see like a SEMrush ad. But if I'm not on SEMrush and let's say I'm a female that has nothing to do with SEO and they get a SEMrush ad, it's kind of pointless, right? So the whole point of this is advertisers use that data to send better ads to users that are more attractive to them, okay? So that is sort of how this works now. Now the problem is this third-party cookie is going to eventually get taken away and moved out of the system. And they're replacing it with these IDs. Now, what IDs are is conceptually they work the same way, but technically they don't. So an example, you could be a company and then you can brokerage a ton of license deals with other data providers. Let's say you make a deal with an internet service provider and get IP information. Let's say you brokerage a deal with, let's just use an easy example here for sake of argument. Let's say you brokerage a deal with Google and get like search data, right? I'm sure they won't do that, or they might, I don't know. then you basically collect a data set. Now, that data set can then be used, and you say, okay, I have a user that is on iPhone 12, they're male, they're in this age range, they go to these sites, Semrush, Reddit, they're in this location, they maybe bought this on Amazon, right? And then they pull all of that together, and they say, this is a unique ID we're going to assign to this user with all those characteristics, right? So you don't actually know who the user is. You just know the data points about them, but it's very good. So you can actually figure out a unique combination of data points and basically pinpoint people that way, right? So they don't actually need to know your name. They just have all this information. So basically, these ID solutions are a way to say, okay, we don't have cookies in the browser anymore, but we can still take a new ID from these other data points that happen on first-party platforms. Could be your Facebook data, right? 7,000 companies are looking at my Facebook data. I thought I was the only one, but now it's 7K, right? It could also be Amazon data for shopping cart, Google search data. And then the ID is now going to be associated with me when I go to a website and see advertisements, and they're going to bid and appropriately based off that ID. So that is what this ID is trying to accomplish. Now, the crux of this is advertisers need data to continue correctly targeting, right? So I make sure I get a SEMrush ad, but a female that has no idea with SEO doesn't get a SEMrush ad, right? So how does this transition happen? So this is the next point I want to talk about, which is some of these publishers, I do want a quick caveat, these are massive news publishers, they're not little mom and pop publishers, so they have the bandwidth and resources to actually test these ID solutions on their own, but also this isn't going to be the same for everybody else. They're saying they have a 200% increase in CPMs on Safari traffic. Now, there's some context I actually want to provide here, which goes a little bit in detail, but I think it's important. Just speaking from an advertiser standpoint or from an ad point of view, Safari monetizes less than Google Chrome and Internet Explorer, and I think also Firefox. And usually it's about half of what Chrome does. So they're saying it's a 4x increase in CPMs. So that means their Safari CPMs either went from like $1 or to $4 or $2, $8. I don't know their exact details. And that brought their CPMs to above Chrome value. So that's kind of is a big deal in my opinion. But again, I don't know all the full data, but that's just to explain what that percent actually means. It means, hey, we brought Safari browser monetization to about the same level or higher than Chrome, which is a big deal when you talk about it in the terms of the online advertising industry, right? So now let's talk about the timeline. So right now, Google is testing, as mentioned in the previous episode, Google's testing 1% of traffic without cookies on Chrome, right? And some companies have reported a 30% drop in CPMs on that tested traffic. Now, my prediction, and I feel like this is fairly reasonable, is if you test currently, you might see a CPM drop, or if you test an ID, you might see that CPM regain. But when the industry shifts and we no longer have third-party cookies and we go to an ID solution, the advertiser dollars that get spent won't change, right? That number will most likely stay the same. And because it most likely stay the same, well, advertiser dollars will just follow where retention goes regardless. And these ID solutions are basically going to guarantee advertisers still have the data they need to target correctly. So again, I get that SEMrush data, but that female who has nothing to do with SEO won't get that SEMrush ad. That will still happen. We might see a little period where your CPMs fluctuate, but then after everything settles, it would be about the same. And I would say this mom and pop website owner won't have anything to worry about. I would say the responsibility is more so on the business side and the partners they work with. So the partners they work with would have to figure things on the business side to ensure there's an ID solution to at least give that data to advertisers to maintain their bids. And that would be my prediction on this. Hopefully that wasn't too much information. Yeah,
yeah. If we can get an applause from the live studio audience, that was incredible. Thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a big topic, and I feel like a lot of the there's a lot of moving parts, And a lot of it is technical things that the everyday person doesn't understand. And then other things are, you know, privacy concerns that the everyday person does understand. And so I'm trying to tie that bridge between, hey, yes, your data matters, but this is how it's actually being used in a business sense by advertisers. And this is why it's being used, right? All they're trying to do is making sure I see a SEMrush ad because I'm interested in SEMrush, right? And someone who's not interested in it doesn't see it. That's basically at the end of the day what they're trying to do. And they're trying to do it extremely accurately.
Yeah.
And then that drives profits to companies. Now, you could, you know, argue if that's a good thing or bad thing on society. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think advertising is a part of our world. It always has been. There's always going to be someone with a sign saying, hey, buy something from me, right? The online is just another way to do it. So I don't think advertising is going to change or go away. Just the way we do it is changing. That's all.
Yeah. And to, if you don't, for the people listening to the podcast, can you, I know you've kind of touched on it here and there, but
yeah,
from a publisher perspective, listening in on this, where do you see they would, where do you think they would notice the biggest impact in this year? And, or if not, why not?
So I would look at, if you have access to this data as a publisher, is look at your revenue and earnings by browser and see if your Safari revenue moves up or down. And you check your Chrome too and see what those differences between the two and just track that difference. If you see no change, don't really need to worry about anything. If you see Safari pull up, hey, it's nice to see. If you see Chrome pull down and Safari pull up, hey, maybe you should have a reach out to, you know, representative that you work with.
Gotcha. Cool. Yeah, I think that was a perfect explanation. You're far more of an expert on that topic than I am.
And you led the way in the SEO conversation.
Yeah, so I'll probably just keep, I think we should just keep chugging along because I don't have much to say on that one other than that was a great explanation. And it's exciting to see that things are changing to, you know, help the publisher in the long run. But, you know, I do wonder how, just like the everyday person, when I saw the number of how many companies have my information, I kind of shrugged it off and was like, yeah, that makes sense. We live in a very digital world with a very open their mindset of they're using it for advertising data. And yes, I mean, sure, they could have my information more than I would want them to, but what are you going to do? It's the digital age.
And I'm in that same boat. Like, I kind of assume all my data is already out there.
Yeah, exactly.
I just, you know, they're not using it to, like, maybe, you know, target me for nefarious reasons. They're just using it to offer me better products that I'm more interested in.
Yeah.
So, you know,
of course someone nefarious could steal that information.
Yeah. Data leak or something. Yeah.
But even that, it's like, well, I have safeguards in my own life to protect me from different things. So it's like, odds are the nefarious kind of things are kind of not as prominent as it is. We really think you're going to like this sponge.
Yeah. I guess that, I mean, this brings me to like a more like conceptual or theory thing on these ID solutions is these IDs, right? They're not going to be attached with a name at all, right? It's just going to take a bunch of data points and basically estimate this is this person, right? So I guess in a bad example or a bad situation, what could happen is when these companies get a data leak, all their unique IDs get leaked along with the data points associated with those, and then someone can then match that with actual people names and then create a data set of everyone's names and all of your interest that was pulled through for all these companies. So like your Amazon order history, your Google searches, your search history, your websites you visit, everything you do online. There could be a point in time where that would be available to someone through various data leaks and someone basically merging data sets. I would say that would, you know, I live on an assumption that that probably already has happened. Most of us do. And I implement safeguards on my own to protect against that. But I just kind of assume that's already going to be a thing.
Yeah. I think for the amount of time that the regular person uses the internet and uses different apps and visits different websites, I think all of us kind of have the assumption that it's out there. And of course, I'm sure if there was a cybersecurity specialist here, they would totally school us on like how in danger we are, which I'm sure we are. But for the everyday person, I, you know, what are you going to do?
I mean, all the terms and services you just blindly accept or all, you know, the little warnings that you just kind of ignore in your day-to-day life with all these apps and online services. Yeah, I mean, you can't get around it,
yeah,
right? Someone's not going to use GPS because they don't want that company to know where they're driving to on their commute. Instead, they want to know how to get from point A to point B without having to think.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So
that's going to be a great episode of the Publisher Lab if we can get a cybersecurity expert in here.
Yeah, there we go.
I might have to save that for Halloween just for how scary that episode would be. But I just want to say thanks to both of you guys for being on the show this week. I appreciate having you guys on. You guys want to send the audience off with any last tidbits of news?
Anything from you, Zach?
Stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.
The storms are all... Winter is always coming when it comes to Google. So stay vigilant. Keep your eyes out and stay publishing.
Awesome. I don't have much news on my end, but I will say if there's anything you'd like us to cover in the show, definitely leave a comment. Anything you'd like to cover in the show, we'll definitely love to hear from you and add to the show and enhance it in any way. But yeah, thank you for watching the Publisher Lab.